We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Good morning. Good morning and happy Friday. Today is March 14th and a lot going on in the news this week. And so we haven't as much covered foreign policy and the conflict that is going on in the Middle East. So wanted to do a little bit of a deep dive this morning. And speaking of deep dives, you can always listen to the On Demand podcast every Friday. New episode coming out today with Congressman Chip Roy talking about codifying all of President Trump's executive order wins, and also this continuing resolution, answering your questions about that, the budget, a new op-ed that he has out. So, ton of stuff. So make sure that you go to AFR.net, click that icon for On Demand. Listen to that as soon as it drops today. And you can also find all of the previous episodes on that page as well. This morning on the radio side, we are doing a deep dive with what's going on in the Middle East, and there is no other better expert than our good friend Joel Rosenberg, who is the editor-in-chief of All Israel News. You can find that at allisrael.com. You can follow him on X at Joel B. Rosenberg, C. Rosenberg. Almost said B. I gave you a letter upgrade. Sorry. So you'll be Joel A. Rosenberg by the time we're done with this, but Joel C. Rosenberg. So good morning, my friend, and where do you want to start? Because, what's the latest coming out of the Middle East?
Well, it's great to be with you, Jenna, and I so loved being with you in person, finally, at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention. That was wonderful to actually sit with you and do the show face-to-face rather than by phone, which we usually do. But, well, I'm in Washington right now, and maybe we start with the fact that this week we launched my new political thriller, The Beijing Betrayal. I was on Fox News Sunday with Shannon Bream on Sunday, obviously, to kick off the book tour, and already the Beijing Betrayal has hit number one as the number one terrorism thriller on Amazon, and we're just getting a tremendous response, and I'm really encouraged by that. The reason that I'm focusing on China right now, even though I focus primarily on the Middle East, is because Communist China is not just a huge, grave, and growing threat to the United States and Taiwan and our allies in the Pacific. But in the last couple of years, the Communist Chinese Party, the Chinese government, has built a strategic alliance, a very dangerous strategic alliance, with the Islamic Republic of Iran. So what you've got is one of the most dangerous countries on the planet, China, building an alliance with one of the other most dangerous countries on the planet, Iran. And, of course, Russia has an alliance with both of them. And this is really serious because just a few weeks ago, before I came to the States for this tour, the speaking tour, I was up on an Israeli military base up on the northern border of Israel, right near Lebanon. And the IDF was showing me 18,000 weapons that they had captured from Hezbollah in these villages in southern Lebanon, and many of them were made in China. I mean, it was clear from the markings on them. So it was Chinese weapons, Russian weapons, and Iranian weapons. So these are weapons that are literally being used to kill Israelis or attack Israelis, and they're coming from China. They're coming from Russia. They're coming from Iran. And so we can't think of the Middle East as somehow isolated, like, oh, let's just talk about the Middle East, and we don't have to talk about how the great nuclear superpowers are funding, fueling, arming Iran in its seven-front war against Israel. It's a very serious issue, and I deal with it fictionally in the Beijing betrayal. But that visit to that IDF base was a very chilling reminder to me that this is not, ultimately, it's not fiction. I'm writing about it to try to capture people's attention and imagination and to warn as well as to entertain. But it is a very real threat. China has turned against Israel since October 7th, and we've really got to raise the alarm bells on this.
Yeah, and I was so delighted to get a copy of your book there in person at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, and I was carrying it around all day. It is a brick. I mean, it is like it is a full thriller, and so I'd encourage all of our listeners to go out and get that book and to read it because, you know, I think that as I've just started reading it, there was a lot that, you know, even though you it's obviously fiction, you know, you weave in a lot of this stuff that maybe we talk about on the news side, but it becomes a little more accessible somehow through storytelling. And I think that's such a wonderful thing. But one of your articles, you know, you mentioned that we need to focus on China. And one of the most popular articles right now on allisrael.com is this headline: If China invades Taiwan, it's World War III. That's why Trump spent more time on China than Israel during the State of the Union. And I hadn't really noticed that in particular until I read this article. That's a fascinating observation. And do you think that the reason for that is because of China's, you know, involvement overall on the world stage?
Yeah, President Trump really gets China. He really raised the China issue and began to get tough on China.
But you got to say first, China, China.
China, yeah. It's China. Yes. Like Jenna, you and I have had some disagreements, but one thing we agree on is China is a problem. We're not going to let them flood the United States with fentanyl. We're not going to let them take over the Panama Canal. We're not going to let them take over Taiwan or work with Iran. We're going to deal with China. No, it's really true that this president, more than any American president, has understood that the China that President Nixon made overtures to and tried to make peace with 50 years ago is not the China of today. The Communist Chinese Party today is one of the most dangerous forces on the planet, and they are moving in multiple directions. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, when China starts arming your worst enemies, Iran and Russia, you know you've got a problem, right? You know, and that's why President Trump has put tariffs on Communist China, because he's trying to do several things. One, he wants to send a signal to Xi Jinping, the president of China, that we're on to him, that we're not going to allow China to dominate the Pacific or take over the Panama Canal or anything else. But there's a bigger issue. President Trump is trying to signal to American companies, it's time to leave China. It's time to come home. It's time to build in America. Stop exporting Americans' jobs and all of our key pharmaceuticals and other key supply chain things, building computers, building phones. You know, Apple Computer. Apple has huge factories in China, and yet the president of Apple has decided to start to shift and invest $500 billion in building Apple factories in the United States. This is the first president ever to help reverse the course here. And that's the key. That's why on Fox News Sunday with Shannon Bream, I noted that no other country in the world did President Trump talk about more in his State of the Union than China, not Israel, not Russia, not Ukraine, but China. And I think it's important, but I still think there's much more the president needs to do. I'm encouraged the direction he's going. Trump certainly gets it. But Trump also has his hands full with Russia and Ukraine, with Gaza, with Iran, with Israel being attacked from all directions. So, and of course, domestic issues, the economy and everything here at home. So We got to pray that President Trump and his team does everything they can every single day to make sure the Beijing betrayal never comes true, Jenna, because what I write about in the Beijing betrayal is a worst case scenario that, God forbid, it should ever happen.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that Trump's focus on China is very similar to his first term. And of course, his trade advisor, Peter Navarro, who I worked with, just, you know, obviously was outside the administration on the campaign side and then personal counsel to Trump. But I worked closely with Navarro on some of these things. And he had observed during the whole COVID pandemic how China was buying up all of the N95 masks and, you know, some of this other stuff that ultimately other countries needed, and then was, you know, selling it back to countries at an exorbitant rate. I mean, you know, all of those things that that they saw much more quickly, I think, than the average person. And so this emphasis on China and how to negotiate with them, I think Trump has shown that he understands that, and there is an emphasis on that. And so where do you expect you know, some of this to go, especially with respect to Taiwan? Because, you know, as Trump has said to Ukraine and to Russia and to the media, you know, he doesn't think that Russia would have invaded Ukraine had he continued to be president after 2020. And so right. Is that his same posture sort of that, you know, China is now rethinking this, or, you know, where do you expect this to go?
Well, let's start with several things. First, China, Communist China, under President Xi Jinping, wants definitively to invade and take over Taiwan. They've been trying to use economic measures, pressure, coercion to get the Taiwanese to decide to sort of re-enter the Communist China orbit and become one China. But that's not working. The Communist Chinese pressure on the democratic nation of Taiwan is having the exact opposite effect. One of the strongest nationalist leaders in Taiwan has just been elected president of the country last year, and he's taking a strong stand against China. He's not trying to be provocative, but he is saying we're never going to become part of Communist China. So that's one. Second, Chinese communist planners, military planners, have been talking for several years about 2027 being the year that they will be ready to attack and devour Taiwan. Now, if Kamala Harris had been elected president, I believe that Xi Jinping would have moved maybe even faster than 2027 to attack and conquer Taiwan, because the Communist Chinese saw President Biden, much less Vice President Harris, as snowflakes that would melt in the heat of international conflict. The fact that President Trump won again, and so decisively, it wasn't controversial, it was overwhelming, and it was a landslide, has thrown a monkey wrench in Beijing's military machine and planning. This is good. But if Communist China were to attack Taiwan, I believe this would lead to World War III. I think, and President Trump said as much in the State of the Union address. I mean, he didn't say it quite as bluntly as that, but he alluded to that. And as you know, I mean, his Trump's dust-up with Vladimir Zelensky in the Oval Office a little over a week ago, what did Trump warn Zelensky about? He said, look, you don't have the card. I'm trying to help you. You won't let me help you. You're not thankful, and you're gambling with World War III. Why is he using this language? Why is Trump using the language of World War III? Because he knows that Communist China has nuclear weapons, nuclear warheads, and ballistic missiles, and they are an evil imperialist nation. Trump knows that Russian President Vladimir Putin is being humiliated, and he's losing in Ukraine. He's lost 800,000 troops. He's right on the verge, I believe, and I believe that President Trump believes that Putin is right on the verge of using tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine to humiliate, destroy, and vaporize the people of Ukraine and to reassert dominance in his part of the world. Then Iran is just, you know, weeks away from being able to build 6 nuclear warheads, which they'll use against Israel if they get it. And so on 3 different fronts, President Trump is actively trying to defuse World War III from erupting, a nuclear war on multiple fronts, but we got to pray for this president because the challenges are immense, and it's not going to be easy. And the Beijing betrayal lays out the China version of World War III.
Well, and we got to take a break here, but I'm going to be right back with my special guest, Joel Rosenberg, author of the brand new book, The Beijing Betrayal. And we'll talk about more of this right after the break when we come right back here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. As we celebrate the many pro-life victories going forward, we rejoice. Preborn's network of clinics have a unique opportunity to advance even further without political persecution. But what does this look like? Preborn is the greatest threat to the abortion industry by rescuing on average 200 babies' lives a day, and they are putting a serious dent into the abortion holocaust. But there are still thousands of babies who are slain daily, and Preborn's goal is to rescue them all. With the help of the pro-life community, meaning you and me, we can save so many more. Please join us in saving all of these precious lives. The ultrasound is the game changer. Once a mother hears that precious heartbeat, she is twice as likely to choose life. If you consider yourself pro-life, we need your help. One ultrasound is just $28. Five ultrasounds are $140. $5,000 sponsors ultrasounds for the entire preborn network for an entire day. So how many lives can you save? Every child is a beautiful gift from God, so please join this cause. To donate securely, please dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back, and I'm speaking with Joel Rosenberg, my special guest this morning. He is the editor-in-chief of All Israel News. You can find that at allisrael.com, and his brand new book is The Beijing Betrayal, and you can get that wherever books are sold, and I would encourage you to encourage him by getting that book, reading it, and I've started it. I was able to get a copy from Joel at NRB, the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, a couple weeks ago in Dallas, Texas. A really great time to connect face-to-face with some of the best conservative broadcasters in the country. And so, Joel, we've been talking about, about China and where the Trump administration is viewing where foreign policy and the world stage is going. So let's just finish up with that issue before moving on to some other critical things that I definitely want to get your comments on.
Well, I appreciate it. Well, one of the reasons I wrote The Beijing Betrayal is because I had never written in any of my 18 or so novels anything about communist China directly. I've written about Russia, I've written about Iran, written about North Korea, and of course other terrorist groups and threats, including ISIS. But I've never dealt directly with communist China, and they are becoming one of the most serious threats to the United States, to Taiwan, to our Pacific allies, and increasingly to Israel and our Arab allies, because Communist China under Xi Jinping has several years ago started signed an agreement with Iran's regime to build a 25-year strategic alliance. Now, this is incredibly dangerous because China has been selling nuclear technology to Iran for years. They're selling weapons to China's selling nuclear technology to Iran. China's selling weapons to Iran. China is buying, communist China is buying 90% of the black market oil that Iran's regime has been illegally selling under the Trump sanctions. China's buying 90% of it. And where's that money going? Well, it goes to Tehran, and then Tehran's regime uses it to funnel terrorism money to Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen. So in a sense, China is funding the direct war against Israel. These are just a few examples of what's happening in real life. Now, in the Beijing Betrayal, Communist China is discovered by my CIA elite operative, Marcus Riker. Riker discovers that Communist China is not several years away from invading Taiwan, but actually just several days, just a few hours away. And simultaneously, Riker uncovers a plot by Communist China, working with radical Islamist organizations, terror groups, to develop an Ebola-like virus that they are going to unleash inside the United States to kill hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Americans just moments before the invasion of Taiwan, so that the United States will be paralyzed by something far worse than COVID-19, which, of course, came from China, came from the Wuhan virus institute in Wuhan, China. So China's already killed 7 million people in the world through its COVID-19 virus, the Wuhan virus. But in the novel, The Beijing Betrayal, they're planning something far deadlier. Now, that's fiction at the moment. But there was an article just last year, I had already written my novel, it just wasn't out yet, by a China expert. And the headline was, China is preparing a direct attack to destroy America. And this China expert, Gordon Chang, goes through this article and talks about how communist China is infiltrating the United States through the Mexican border with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of agents aligned with the communist Chinese military, the PLA, the People's Liberation Army. And then one other thing, they found a laboratory, the U.S. raided and took over a laboratory in California, which was actually owned and run by the communist Chinese army, which was developing biological warfare viruses. And they found on the site 20 potentially infectious pathogens, including the pathogen for Ebola. Now, I had already written the novel. It just wasn't, it was all done. And then this news actually came out. And that, you know, so sometimes I'm trying to write fiction to, yes, to entertain, but also to warn. But sometimes I swerve inadvertently into things that are real, even though I'm just thinking about, well, gosh, what might they be trying to cook up? What could communist China cook up in the future that would be so devastating to the United States that we wouldn't be able to recover? But it looks like maybe they're already onto this, the novel notwithstanding.
And this is all, you know, really scary stuff when we come down to it, Joel Rosenberg. And, you know, how does this, and I want to just ask you one more question on China, and then I want to get into the other topics, but how does this fit with, you know, the Christian worldview on eschatology, and obviously, or the study of the end times? And obviously, you know, there are different views that we could say are, you know, intent of the Christian worldview, because Revelation hasn't happened yet. And so we're trying to understand the things that have been revealed in Scripture. But with your eschatological view, how does some of this perhaps fit in?
Well, that's a great question, Jenna. And you're the first person this week during this book tour that has asked me on that angle. I have been speaking recently on where does China fit in Bible prophecy. And people can Google Joel Rosenberg and China and Bible prophecy and see some of the sermons that I've been giving over the last few weeks. But the short version for you, Jenna, and your audience is this. There are several references and allusions to communist China, or at least China, in the Bible. One is in Revelation 16, where it talks about the kings of the east will come from east of Israel, east of Jerusalem, and they will come up the Euphrates River in the end of days, in what the Bible describes as the tribulation period. And the Euphrates River will have dried up during that period, and the armies of eastern enemies of Israel will actually be sort of driving up the Euphrates River. And where will they go? They will come to Israel, and they will fight at a place called Har Megiddo, or Har Megiddon, which is Hebrew for the term we call today Armageddon. That's where one of the last horrific battles of human civilization will happen in the end of days, according to the book of Revelation, Revelation 16. Now, I believe that China is one of those kingdoms of the East that will be part of it. Can I prove it? No, I cannot prove it. But when we talk about China, North Korea, Pakistan, other hostile countries to Israel, it's not difficult to think that if, you know, whenever the tribulation happens, that China would be a part of it. That being said, there is an actual direct reference to China. In ancient history, China, even today, Sino is the word that refers to China. So people talk about a Sino-American expert. That's a Chinese-American, you know, global affairs expert. Well, in the Bible, in ancient Hebrew, the people of China are called Sinim. That's plural for the people of China, Sino, and then this becomes Sinim. Well, in Isaiah 49, verse 12, it talks about there's going to be a great spiritual awakening in the last days. The gospel will be spreading all over the world, the good news of salvation. I'm using some New Testament terms right now, but I encourage people to look at Isaiah 49. And the Bible says that God the Father is speaking to Jesus the Son, and he says, it's too small a thing for you just to redeem the people of Israel, the people of Jacob. You are going to bring my salvation to the ends of the earth. And then it says that people will come from the ends of the earth into the kingdom, including the people from Sinim. That's the people of China. And so as I've been talking about, yes, China is going to be a great enemy, not just of the United States and freedom, but of Israel in the last days, and they're already becoming that. But also, people are going to be coming to faith in Jesus Christ in the last days in China in mass numbers. And a Boston University study just came out 2 years ago showed that the number of Chinese people that have turned away from communism and away from atheism to faith in Jesus Christ has gone from 1 million 40 years ago to 100 million today. There are 100 million followers of Jesus Christ in China. So I believe the Bible talks about both the ugly, the danger, the evil of China in the last days, but also God's love and redemption of many of the Chinese people. And we're already seeing this come to pass. So it's a mixed story, but it's very encouraging that many Chinese are going to come to faith, and they are. And I know many today.
That is incredible. And, you know, I think that we can't talk about these things without commenting on the biblical worldview perspective and seeing, you know, where does this fit and align with biblical prophecy, and what should we understand about not only the book of Revelation, but throughout even the Old Testament prophecy and projecting toward the end of all things. And so it's actually surprising to me that this is the first time you've been asked this question when, you know, clearly so much of your book is, as you say so often, Joel Rosenberg, that, you know, your books are ripped from tomorrow's headlines. And so, you know, as we're looking forward into the future and understanding, you know, where biblical prophecy fits in. But you mentioned as well, you know, all of the Christians who will be affected by these things, but not only in China, but in today's headlines, in Syria also. So, you know, let's get to that as well, because that's all going on in Syria. And Trump is also going to be going to Saudi Arabia in May. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was there this week to negotiate some of those peace deals between Ukraine and Russia. So there's a lot going on. But let's start with Syria and what's going on with the horrible, just tragic murder of so many Christians there.
Yeah, it's a very tragic story, and I just published on All Israel News, and our sister site is actually originally published on All Arab News, and I also did a video for All Israel News and All Arab News. People can Google Joel Rosenberg, Syria, and Christians and find that. But basically what's happening is over the last week, about 1,000 Syrians have been massacred by the new radical Islamist terror regime in Damascus, a political terror group called HTS. They and their allies are involved in what's called revenge killings. They're just going across the countryside, and they're killing people who they believe either were supportive of the previous regime run by Bashar al-Assad, the previous president of Syria, or that whether they were literally supportive of Assad or not, as long as the HTS, you know, terrorists think that you're supportive of Assad, they will kill you. They will torture you. And many of these are Christians. Not all. Some are Druze. Some are Kurds. Some are Alawites. But what's happening is these revenge killings, this is a spasm of violence in Syria that we really haven't seen, this level of sort of Syrian-on-Syrian violence since the days of the ISIS caliphate, when Christians were being beheaded and crucified and just gunned down. But during the Assad regime, now Assad was horrible. Bashar al-Assad was the demon of Damascus. I mean, he just was horrible. And he killed hundreds of thousands of people. But the Christians of Syria actually felt slightly, I emphasize, safer with Assad in power than the fear that radical Islamists would take over, like ISIS. Why? Because Assad needed the Christians to kind of be loyal to him, because at the time there were about 1.3 million Christians in Syria, and they were a minority out of a country of about 23 million, but they still sort of were loyal, not because they loved Assad or all the horrible things he did, but because in living in a dangerous country, he kept them safe because he needed them. Well, now with Assad gone, living in exile in Moscow, the people that overthrew Assad are coming after the Christians. And this is a very dangerous situation. We really need to be praying for the Christians of Syria. And I will just note one more thing, Jenna, that before the civil war, the Arab Spring in Syria, there were about 1.3 million Christians. Again, maybe not all born again, but from all kinds of different denominations. And they weren't Muslims. They described themselves as Christians. Now there's only about 300,000. And that's because many were killed and many fled. And now there's this new spasm of violence. And we really, really need to be praying for our brothers and sisters who love Jesus, or at least are part of the church. Maybe they don't fully know Jesus, but they're part of the church in Syria. And a new wave of violence has been unleashed against them.
We do need to be praying for them, absolutely. And thank you for that, Joel Rosenberg. And before we run out of time, let's turn to Trump's forthcoming meeting next, in the next few months, in the Middle East and going to Saudi Arabia. What do you anticipate for him to accomplish there?
Well, it's interesting that President Trump has a good working relationship with the leadership in Saudi Arabia. He really sees President Trump does, to have a peace deal between Israel and the Saudis. He wants the Saudis to work with the United States to help clean up Gaza, right, and rebuild Gaza. That's part of their conversations. But he also, doesn't hate the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, a leader that I've met with twice, spent more than 4 hours with him over two different trips, brought evangelical leaders to meet with MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. President Biden hated MBS and turned on him, and that did not go well for the United States. President Trump has a very different view of MBS. So MBS right now is hosting peace talks this last few days between Russia and Ukraine. And let's be hopeful. Let's be prayerful. But I think there's a new Saudi Arabia emerging, and we should have a good relationship with them like Trump wants, not a terrible relationship like Biden created.
Well said. Well, Joel Rosenberg, really appreciate all of the updates on this Friday morning. You can get Joel's new book, The Beijing Betrayal, anywhere books are sold. Follow him at allisrael.com and also at Joel C. Rosenberg on X. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back. And this week would not be complete without commenting on the little kerfuffle that happened in a House committee meeting this week, where somehow calling a male member of the House Mr. caused a total meltdown from the left. This, of course, is referring to this person who identifies himself as Sarah McBride, but he is Mr. McBride in reality, right? And so because it is the federal government's official stance now of recognizing that there are only two genders and that gender is immutable, then I don't really see the problem here. But of course, the left is melting down and they're saying, oh, this is mean-spirited, and you know, somehow you're just wanting to call the dude in the dress Mister when you shouldn't. But in case you missed this clip, here is how it went down. This is cut six.
I now recognize the representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ranking Member Keating, also wonderful.
Mr. Chairman, could you repeat your introduction again, please?
Yes, we have set the standard on the floor of the House, and I'm simply...
What is that standard, Mr. Chairman? Would you repeat what you just said when you introduced a duly elected representative from the United States of America, please?
I will. The representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride.
Mr. Chairman, you are out of order. Mr. Chairman, have you no decency? I've come to know you a little bit, but this is not decent.
We will continue this.
You will not continue it with me unless you introduce a duly elected representative the right way.
This hearing is adjourned.
Okay, so a lot to unpack there, because first of all, this whole meltdown by saying you will introduce a duly elected member the right way. Well, the right way is recognizing biological reality, that the guy is a guy, and in dressing up in makeup and a skirt doesn't change that. And so the contention here from the Democrats that somehow it's inappropriate to call a man by the actually biologically correct pronouns is indecent is just another spin on the ridiculous language. But one of the things that nobody is talking about in this exchange is that when Representative Self, the chairman, called Mr. McBride, the representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride, his response was to say, thank you, Madam Chairman, right? So it was almost like this tongue-in-cheek, like, fine, if you're going to call me the pronoun I don't prefer, I'm going to call you the pronoun that's incorrect. And there were a couple of people on the left that caught on to that, but a lot of the conversation around this exchange was only about the outburst from the Democrat leader, rather than calling out McBride for saying, okay, well, is he being indecent then to call the chairman, Madam Chairman? I mean, this is what devolves into absurdity when we think that pronouns are just a matter of preference, because it may be that McBride prefers female pronouns, but the actually correct way to speak in the English language is to call him a mister. And nobody needs to buy into that delusion. And so Representative Self was on the Michael Knowles show on Daily Wire right after this exchange. And Knowles asked the question that I think gets to the heart of the matter. Why does this actually matter? Because the left will always say, well, what does it matter to you if you just go along with their preferred pronouns and extend courtesy to the transgender individuals? I mean, what is it harming you to give them what they're asking for as a matter of courtesy? So here was that exchange between Knowles and Representative Self. Cut seven.
Why does it matter? What do you say to your Democrat colleague there, the ranking member, who starts raising his voice, threatens to walk out of the proceeding because you referred to a man as Mr.? What do you say to those people who say it is disrespectful for you to call a man who thinks he's a woman Mr.?
Well, Michael, I'm a retired Green Beret. I'm not even sure what all the fuss is about. I mean, he is allowed to live his life. In fact, I spent 25 years on active duty defending his right to live his life as he chooses. But I don't have to participate in his fantasy. So I am under no obligation to participate in something that he chooses to portray himself as.
That's exactly it, is that we are not forced to lie simply because someone else prefers it. Calling a man a woman is a lie. Now, I've said for a long time, for regular listeners of this show, when somebody wants to adopt a female assumed name, like Sarah McBride, for example. I don't really have a problem with that because the name anybody can name themselves or call, you know, their first name, anything. I mean, we have some people like the name, for example, Jesse can be a man or a woman, and you don't automatically know in context. Sometimes the spelling, if it's an I-E, but even J-E-S-S-E can occasionally mean a man or a woman. That's not an inherent contradiction. And so even though the name Sarah, like the name Caitlin, by the way, tends to generally refer to woman, it is not a lie to call someone by their preferred name, because that's a matter that is generally just a matter of preference, or just how, you know, their parents named them, or you can legally change your first name, and that is not inconsistent with reality. Right. And so there's a difference between calling this person Sarah McBride versus madam or she or her, because the pronouns that we use in the English language absolutely refer to the difference between biologically a man and a woman. So it is a lie, and it is inconsistent to say ma'am when it is actually a mister, or madam when it is actually a man. And so Representative Self is absolutely right that buying into this lie and basically being socially pressured to participate in a leftist fantasy, if we start doing that, the natural consequence of participating in that delusion is what we're seeing in the whole controversy of men in women's restrooms, of men in women's sports. And if we yield the pronoun debate, then we are yielding ground when we are standing up for the measurable difference between man and woman, the biological, inherent, immutable difference between man and woman. And so Tommy Lahren, who's on Outkick Sports and occasionally on Fox News, she posted a conversation from her show that she had around this debate. And while she said she's against men and women sports, she also said that she thinks it's wrong to misgender. Listen to what she had to say on her show. Cut it.
There is a representative who is transgender. Sarah McBride was purposely referred to as Mr., and it's getting a lot of traction. I feel like it's mean-spirited to do it just to be mean. Now, that doesn't mean that I want transgender people in women's sports or women's spaces, because that has an actual physical, tangible impact.
Okay, but it is not mean to simply tell the truth and use the correct pronouns. Participating in a delusional lie that men can become women leads to the consequence of men in women's sports, of men in women's spaces, because worldviews have consequences and actual impact. And so Tommy Lahren, by the way, it does not pretend to be a moral conservative. She comes basically from a libertarian perspective. She's not morally grounded whatsoever. And so this is kind of the view of saying, well, it's mean-spirited. Let's just kind of give them a little bit, but we're going to draw the hard and fast line on men and women's sports. It's the same thing that the libertarians want to do with a lot of other debates, and what a lot of people are suggesting with the pro-life debate, that if you don't draw the bright line at where it naturally is, and the moral bright line that life begins at conception, and you want to arbitrarily draw it somewhere down the line, then that will necessarily arbitrarily move, and you won't be able to defend it wherever you want to arbitrarily draw that line. So if she's saying, you know, listen, I think it's mean-spirited to not call someone a she if that's what he prefers, then what's to stop that argument from saying, well, if she prefers then to be in her restroom or her sports, then why are you drawing the line there? And that is a much more difficult argument to defend, even if Tommy Lahren's suggesting, well, that's actual impact and actual consequences. Well, the actual impact starts when you start using the lie and participating in the lie of pronouns. And she's not seeing that worldview has consequences, that what you believe translates into actual law and policy with actual impact. And so this is where conservatives and Christians in particular have to always draw the line at where the law of nature and of nature's God draws it. Because if we give language over to the left and we say that this is arguable and it's debatable and that saying he can become a she doesn't really mean anything in reality, that doesn't have actual impact, we are denying reality and we're denying that language has any meaning. What Tommy Lahren is suggesting here is that our language and our concepts don't have any rational bearing on reality. And that's just an absurd argument on face. Because if we are going to communicate meaningfully, then we have to be precise in our language. We have to draw contours and boundaries to what words and definitions actually mean. And if that can be arbitrary, and what it means to be a man or a woman can differ based on our epistemological standpoint and our view, and if you're over on the left and you're viewing reality in a different way or from a different perspective, this is what's called standpoint epistemology, then we're suggesting that reality is not fixed and it's not objective and it's subjective to the whim of whatever your perspective is. Now, people can have perspective on a lot of different things, and there are some things that are arguable, but reality and fact is not one of them. We need to define the contours of reality first, then we can debate policy, we can debate what is best, what's, you know, what ultimately is good for society, you know, some of those things. But we cannot try to blur the lens and the lines between reality and what genuinely is arguable and debatable. But that's what the left is doing. They're trying to start the argument by saying that the difference between man and woman is debatable, and it depends on your standpoint. And what Tommy Lahren is suggesting is that it's mean to say no to that, to say no, reality shows us empirically. This isn't a matter of my perspective. It's not a matter of my religion. It's not a matter of my country, my customs, my culture. It's a matter of fixed objective truth that a man is a man, a woman is a woman, immutably, and that the English language provides terminology to explain, in reality, the rational contours of those distinctions. Every language has those same boundaries. If we are going to communicate effectively, then I have to be able to describe the limitations of the object or idea that I am attempting to communicate. And this is what Michael Knowles explains brilliantly, by the way, in his book Speechless. If you haven't read that, I would really encourage you to read that, because he talks about how the left is attempting to hijack language for the purpose of warping and intentionally misrepresenting through language rational reality. And if we do not draw the line at objective truth and say, here is the correct definition of the contours of the concepts that translate to reality, then we're not going to get to the consequence of protecting women's sports. We're not going to get to the consequence of protecting women's spaces like restrooms. We're not going to get to the consequence of protecting minors and kids from all of these so-called transgender affirmation surgeries or of hormones or of other actual consequences from the ideas that language communicates. This is incredibly important. And for somebody like Tommy Lahren, who has such a big platform and who says that she is a conservative, to actually suggest that it's mean-spirited means she does not understand at all what the left is trying to do or what this debate is really about, because it's not about courtesy. It's not about decency. It's not about just a preference. This ultimately is about reality. And either you approach an argument agreeing that reality is reality, or you're insane and we don't even need to have a conversation. We cannot approach the left entering into or even entertaining the idea that biological truth, that empirical truth, is debatable. Otherwise, we are going to lose the policy arguments because we have already given up the moral objective ground. It absolutely matters. And so this is not just a matter of, you know, causing a viral moment or, you know, saying, well, you know, I choose to not participate in a fantasy, and that's my choice, but other people can. You know, I wouldn't have an abortion, but it's okay if other people do. I can't comment on that. No. This is all about what is rational in reality and the truth that God presented us to in our empirical reality. If we do not stand firmly on fixed objective fact and truth, we are losing the policy debate before we even engage the argument. It matters. All right, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Have a great weekend. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.